Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Adele Parks. She's the author of 20 best-selling books. Her latest, Just My Luck, is about a lottery win so big it changes everything. Adele is a proud ambassador for the National Literacy Trust and is a judge for the Costa Book Awards and the British Book Awards. Also joining us is Martin Walker. He's a prize-winning journalist and the author of several acclaimed works of non-fiction, including The Cold War, A History. The 13th novel in the Dodoin Mysteries is out now, A Shooting at Chateau Rock. The stories follow the crime cases of Bruno, chief of police, and are all set in rural France. Also with us is David Albertin, who was born in South Africa and emigrated to Canada when he was 10. Since 2005, he's been a competitive tennis player and coach. In his debut novel, Undercard, he explores the volatile world of professional boxing. It's set in Las Vegas and takes place over 24 hours. And finally, on tonight's book show is Charlie Mills, who's just published his debut children's book, It's Cool to Be Me, at the age of 22. It follows a child on an enchanting adventure of a lifetime. It looks at the worries that children face every day, whether it's making friends or dealing with bullies. Charlie says that it's important we promote positivity. So that's tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
I am unwritten, can't read my mind, I'm undefined. I'm just beginning, the pen's in my hand. Before you open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can let it in. No one else, no one else can speak the words on your lips. Treat yourself in words unspoken. Live your
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is best-selling author Adele Parks. She's a proud ambassador for the National Literacy Trust and the Reading Agency's Six Book Challenge. She's also a judge for the Costa Book Awards and the British Book Awards. And she's just published her 20th novel in 20 years. It's called Just My Luck. And it has been very lucky so far. It's gone straight to the Sunday Times bestseller list. It's about a lottery win so big it changes everything. Welcome to the book show, Adele.
Hello, lovely to be here. Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. And what an exciting topic for a book. I mean, everyone must have talked about what it would be like to win the lottery.
Oh my gosh, isn't it? It's so surprising. When I did have the idea, I kept thinking, well, somebody must have written that before. And then I realized nobody actually has. So you're absolutely right. I think everybody, every sort of supper party across the world, there's a moment where you think, what would you do with that money? The idea actually came to me from a friend who works for the British Lottery Company. And we were catching up. We hadn't seen each other for a couple of years and we were catching up. And he was telling me some of the stories that some of them are fabulous, you know, super exciting and people's reactions to winning the money, etc. But just in passing, he said to me sort of towards the end of the conversation, he was telling me about sort of the duty of care the lottery people have for winners, because often this wealth is sort of from being, you know, relatively poor to extremely wealthy, which is a very different journey than if you, say, worked for it and you've had incremental increases in your wealth, or you've inherited it and it's all you've ever known. And therefore, they sort of give advice on, you know, they put you in touch with financial advisors and accountants and all that sort of thing. And just in passing, he said, and if it's an enormous win, we'd, of course, put you in touch with security, you know, for kidnap risks, etc. And it was just extraordinary, that moment of thinking, wow, imagine you win this huge amount of money, you think all your dreams have come true, all your problems are over, and you find out, no, actually, this huge amount of money comes with a whole new set of problems, because of course with a huge amount of money comes jealousy, and in the book, jealousy, betrayal, threats. And so I just thought, gosh, that's exciting, I've got to write about that.
Yes, it's a great idea. And it's to do with a few couples who have a syndicate together.
Exactly that. There's three of them, three couples, so six adults, and they've known each other for 15 years. They all got very friendly when they all had their first baby, and they did that thing that I think many people can relate to, where because they didn't live near their family, their sort of new friends become their family. In fact, they name themselves their frimily. They think they're friends that are like family, and they're super close, and they all have more children. They all grow up in the same area. The kids go to the same school. The eldest ones start dating. They're all very friendly. And they have certain rituals, as friendship groups tend to, that they do together. So they, you know, they spend bonfire night together, and they have regular suppers. But one of the things they've done right since the babies were tiny tots is buy a ticket for the lottery, and they use the same numbers week after week. And the numbers have never come up in a big way. They've won sort of 10, 20 pounds here, there, and put that towards sort of, you know, a takeaway the next week. But there's a little tiff with the friendship group, and we don't really get to the, we don't know why, not to start with. There's a tiff with the friendship group, and the way intense friendships can work, it goes very quickly from a tiff to a rift, and people say things they regret, things they can't take back, and there's a huge fallout, and two of the couples leave the syndicate group. And the final couple, the third couple, who are Alexi and Jake, buy the ticket the next week with the same numbers. And that very week, the numbers come up and the ticket is worth £18 million. I know. You can imagine, it was such fun imagining. And of course, they have all the legal right to this money. But is there a moral right? And what do you owe your friends? And what does that friendship group mean to you? And the other two couples actually go to, the point of the book is they go to extraordinary lengths for money. And the book is about what we can buy and what we can't buy, and what we should and definitely shouldn't buy. Because it investigates, does everyone and everything come with a price or have a price? I really did enjoy writing it.
Oh, I bet. It's a great subject. And were you sort of questioning yourself throughout the whole thing, wondering what you would do in all the different scenarios?
Yes. And we started playing that game with a lot of people, actually. You know, in our family, we would ask, and then we would ask friends and things. And it's interesting, because to start with, people always say, well, I would give to charity. And then I always say, well, how much would you give to charity? And that's, I think there was a Jane Austen book where there's an old chap dying and he asked the heir to look after his daughters. And at first, said, oh, I'll give them 100,000, and then I'll give them 5,000. I'll give them 1,000, you know. And I think that sort of thing can happen. It's the same with thinking, I'll give to charities. You would hope that people would, you know, want to share the wealth. But once the money's actually there, it's quite interesting how some people behave. I actually worked out that the only way for it to really work for you is for you to sort of identify the people you want to take with you. So your close family, for instance, you probably have to make sure they have some level of winnings out of this, because otherwise you leave people behind. It becomes very isolated, very lonely, because that normally, you know, we mix with people that have sort of similar money and house and lifestyle to our own. And if one of those friendship in the friendship group, if one of them suddenly gets incredible wealth, they move away, then and they try and kind of burst into a new social set, can that possibly work?
Mm.
So, yeah, it's all very interesting.
It's fascinating, isn't it? And also the idea how other people, of course, would react, you know, your close friends and family. So looking at someone winning, there's the couple in this book, £18 million. So if they wanted to share their wealth with some friends, let's say, you know, if they thought, well, let's give them 5,000, the people getting the money could obviously think, oh, my goodness, that's amazing. Thank you so much. How wonderful. But they could also think, 5,000, you've just won 18 million.
Correct.
It's just a drop in the ocean for you.
Or they could think it's patronizing, because actually in normal life, when would you give your friend cash?
Yeah.
You wouldn't, you know, no. In normal life, you might buy your friend a lovely box of chocolates, a lovely bunch of flowers. You know, if you know your friend's feeling down, you might sort of say, send a gift, a little, you know, a little something. But you're unlikely to send straightforward cash. So the only time cash comes into it is if there's an issue, you know, if they're maybe in debt or whatever. And then if you pile in, if you're the person with the lottery win and you pile in, does that alter the friendship then? Does it become something that's not quite a friendship? Is it more of a working relationship then? I don't know. This is all the kind of things that are investigated in Just My Luck. It's quite sort of, I think it does make people think. You very kindly said it has gone straight into the number one position, actually, on its first week of sales. And I'm certain it's because everybody wants to kind of look over someone else's shoulder and thinks, well, what would you do with it? And then what would I do with it? So, yeah, it's fun.
Definitely.
I also, lots of fun with visiting incredible shops to see how the rich really do spend their money. That was hilarious. And it turns out I don't think I'm cut out to be uber wealthy, because I would walk out of shops and say to my husband, £900, £900 for a T-shirt. Who pays £900 for a T-shirt? and sort of be outraged, you know. So do you know what you could spend that money on? Do you know how many children could be educated with that sort of money? You know, so it's looking at that kind of... you know, what is the value? What value do you place on things?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. It's a brilliant subject, which I'm sure most people can relate to in some way or another. We all need money for whatever things. So it's a subject that people talk about on a daily basis, really.
Yes, indeed.
So how does this compare with other books you've written? As I said, it's your 20th novel in 20 years. I know you've written a couple of historical novels, but most of them have been contemporary, haven't they?
Yes, and I would say most of them have been contemporary, and I would say the last sort of four or five have been what we're calling domestic noir. So sort of psychological thrillers where you give... relatively ordinary people a dilemma, or you put them in extraordinary circumstances. So whilst this sounds sort of a lot of fun because it's about a lottery, it does become quite dark because, as I say, people are prepared to do some dreadful things for money. And certainly the book before that, which was Lies, 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 that was a book about... a man discovering very early on he couldn't be the biological father of the child he'd brought up for many years, and what was the secret behind that child's heritage. And so the domestic noir is slightly different from psychological thrillers because they always happen in the home. And so the twist, whether that's another book I once wrote, finding out that, your best friend is trying to seduce your son, or, you know, sort of threats within your home. I think that's particularly interesting for me because I believe that all of us are most interested in our friends and family above everything else, above money, above our work. You know, in the end, that's what it comes down to. And so if we feel that part of our life is threatened, that's when our true colors come out. And so I do get sort of quite the emotional range from my characters by putting them in this situation. And it is a lot of fun, actually, even though I go to quite dark places, putting your characters in these extreme situations, but knowing you can save them if you want to, is a lot of fun. Yeah.
And how about the judge work that you do? As I mentioned, mention in the introduction, judging for the Costa Book Awards and the British Book Awards. That must be great to do that.
It is. I actually didn't judge for the British Book Awards this year because, in fact, I was entered and I'm shortlisted.
Oh.
So, yes, so Lies, Lies, Lies is shortlisted for Book of the Year for 2019. So I couldn't judge this year because even though you're all on different panels, it's just awkward if, you know, you just in the wrong place in the brochure. You need to be one place or the other, I think.
Yes, no fair.
But but for years I have done that, and for many years I've done the Costa, and the Costa Short Story Award is super interesting, I believe, because anyone can enter, whether you're published or unpublished, and we receive all the entries completely blind. So we don't know where that person is from. We don't know their age, their gender. We know nothing about them. There's not a name or anything on it. And I love that. I think it's very exciting. And we sort of, in the end, get down to a short list of three. There's a judging panel of five of us, and we get down to, initially there are hundreds and hundreds of entries, and we have a process, and we get down to three, and then those three are judged, they're recorded and put out to the general public, and they can be voted for by the general public, and they pick the winner, which I think is extraordinary and very exciting, because that doesn't happen in many awards where people who are actually reading these things get to choose. And I think it sort of takes any level of politics out of it, and it's just genuinely about who's enjoying what. And I love it. It's very exciting.
It must be very difficult to choose, though. I mean, I'm sure it's quite easy to read something and decide that you don't really like it. It hasn't moved you, hasn't made you laugh, hasn't really done anything for you. But I guess there are so many reasons why you can enjoy reading something. It must be hard to sort of narrow it down.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. I think we find it very easy to sort of say, oh, that was a no. And then we might have a pile of, initially it gets down to about 60. And then out of that 60, we might whittle it down to about 12. And I think once it gets down to that last 12, it is tricky. Because personal taste, there's five judges, and personal taste very much comes into reading. Of course it does. And so people might say, oh, well, this one absolutely chimed with me. And it might be to do with personal circumstances as well. If somebody is writing a story that you can particularly empathize with or about an experience you've been through, then I think that has to be sort of factored in. But in fact, we're a mixed bunch. Three of us are novelists, but in very different genres. One's an agent, and one's a sort of producer and blogger, and so we have a very different viewpoint, and somehow we do always manage, over the years we've always managed to sort of shake it out. And actually winners of the Costa Short Story Award have gone on to get contracts with publishers for novels, and gone on to have careers in as novelists. And so I think we have somehow managed to shake it out correctly. But yes, of course, there's personal taste. And the other thing I would say for Costas, because it's open now, so if anybody's interested, they ought to look it up and have a think about entering. But we quite often get told, oh, your last three were very gloomy, the three you picked. And do you always have to write a gloomy story? Absolutely not. We're looking, we love a comedic story. When you're reading hundreds and hundreds of short stories, it's actually marvelous if you do come across something funny. But actually, people find it very difficult to write a humor. Books are often dismissed as, oh, it's a very light book. And I think, gosh, if you knew how hard it is to write a light book, to write a genuinely comedic book. But yes, it's open now. So do, listeners, please do go and look up the competition if you're at all interested.
Yes, we will do. Fantastic. Costa Short Story Awards. Well, it's been lovely to chat with you, Adele Parks. Thanks ever so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
If listeners want to get a copy of your new book, it's called Just My Luck, and it's available to buy on our website on tre.radio. Adele, thanks for joining us, and we hope to catch up again soon.
Thank you very much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from France is Martin Walker. He's a prize-winning journalist and the author of several acclaimed works of non-fiction, including The Cold War, A History. He's with us on The Book Show to talk about his 13th novel in the Dodoin Mysteries. It follows the crime cases of Bruno, chief of police, and is set in rural France. The latest book is called A Shooting at Chateau Rock. Welcome to The Book Show, Martin.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. So which came first for you? Did you start writing fiction first or the non-fiction?
No, I began writing non-fiction, I suppose because I was because of the journalism. My first book was about the history of the extreme right in Britain and the National Front back in the days of the 70s. But when I first began coming to the Périgord, I was just absolutely blown away by this region, its history and its food and its traditions. And so I wrote a book about the Lascaux caves, you know, these 18,000-year-old painted caves here, which are really a sort of a Sistine Chapel of historic, of prehistoric peoples. And the same caves, the same region in World War II at the time of the resistance against the German occupation. And that was a novel called The Caves of Périgord. And that really got me started on wanting to use this place in fiction. And now I use it in my Bruno novels all the time, to the point where I think the Périgord itself is a character pretty much in the books.
Yes. And when you first started writing fiction, that first book, if you can remember, was it a real change for you from writing all the journalism articles and the non-fiction previously?
Well, yes. Although, I mean, I think in a way I was so innocent about it. I mean, I'd never done anything like a writing course. And I mean, when people later on asked me, well, how did you tackle dialogue? And frankly, I thought, well, you know, the guy says something and you put quotation marks around it and then you add he said or she said or she objected or something. I never actually thought it was a problem, which I suppose just goes to show how badly, you know, trained I was in those ways. But you learn quickly how to, you know, whatever you know things there are in fiction. I mean, I'm still baffled when I hear people talk about narrative arcs and the three act planning process of preparing a plot and so on. I mean, I start with an idea and off we go. I don't, you know, plan it too much all the way through, because I know that something will change in the course of writing.
Mm.
I remember one particular novel, The Devil's Cave, which the Germans gave much better title. They called it Femme Fatale, because there was indeed a very dangerous, seductive, wicked woman involved, very beautiful, who was to seduce poor Bruno for her own purposes. And, of course, in my plan, he's just a guy, and he falls for her seductive ways. But when I came to write that chapter, it was like a force field coming out of my desk at me. I mean, as though Bruno was saying, I am not going to drop my trousers for that woman. He just refused to do it. And I thought, gosh, I'm going to have to rewrite the whole of the ending now. But he's getting a life of his own. This is really strange. So, I mean, ever since then, I've been very much aware that you know, the best laid plans of any writer can change in the course of writing it. If you have a character that you want to be faithful to.
Yes, you need to be adaptable, don't you?
Yes, very much so. A bit like a policeman, I suppose.
So what can you tell us about Bruno as a character?
Okay, well, I'm told by publicists, I ought to say, that Bruno is popular because all women want to have an affair with him and all men want to be like him, which I think is not altogether right. But he is, I mean, he's based upon a real person. He's based upon a guy who is my tennis partner and who has taught me a lot about cooking and was a great hunter. And he was 10 years in the French army. He is the local village policeman, and he spends all of his spare time teaching the village kids to play rugby in winter and tennis in summer. And he's my tennis partner, and we're good chums. And he was the one who inspired me to write a novel about a country policeman in the Perigord. And he's somebody who, he hates arresting anybody. He hates to wear a gun. He likes just to sort of talk things out with people. And he's a decent man. And, it's a real pleasure to know policemen who are like that. I think it's only possible deep in the countryside, as we are here in the Perigord, the nearest local town is fewer than 2,000 inhabitants. So it's possible, I think, in this kind of countryside to have that kind of relationship where he knows everybody in town. He's danced with all of the wives at their weddings. He's buried a lot of the grandfathers. He's taught all the kids to play sports. He knows everybody, and he's trusted by them. So writing about a cop like that really was great fun.
Yeah,
and equally, I could bring in the food as well, and the wine and the region.
Oh, lovely! So, when you wrote the first book, had you already decided that it was going to be a series?
No, I hadn't. But my wife Julia, who's also a writer and has published some novels as well, Julia used to work in publishing, and she's always the first person to read something that I produce. And she read the manuscript and said, I think you've got something here, but you can't call him Pierrot. You have to have an international name. So how about Bruno? And then she said, publishers are going to be more interested if they think it's a series. So go away and write five paragraphs, one on each of the next five books in the series. So I've always worked upon the principle that my wife is always right. So I went away and I wrote those five paragraphs, and she was indeed right.
Yes.
And of course she is the great expert on cooking. She and I will work on the cookbooks together, and all of the food that's in Bruno, I have to cook myself, but with Julia standing at my shoulder and supervising, as it were.
So, what kind of food does he cook? Give us an example. Make us hungry.
Well, bœuf bourguignon, which is your classic French beef stew. And it's beef stewed in with carrots in Burgundy wine, hence bœuf bourguignon. Well, I thought, let's have it. Why don't we do it with Bergerac wine? So I make it not just with carrots, but I also like to put in some onions, a little bit of a bacon back. Then I use Bergerac wine from this region and my own homemade Vin de Noir. That's walnut wine that I make every year. When you make it, you get 8 litres of a very basic red wine, kind of local plonk. You add in a litre of not entirely legal eau de vie, and you add in 40 green walnuts that you have to pick before the middle of June, all chopped up, and half a kilo of sugar. Stir it all up, leave it in a dark corner for 2 months, filter it, and drink. And it's rather like port. It's delicious. And for cooking, it's wonderful. It really is good.
How fabulous. Did you make that up yourself?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool.
We're going to do this. And so that was that's the bœuf à la Périgordine, it's now called in the cookbook.
Fabulous. So looking at the latest book then, A Shooting at Chateau Rock, what can you tell us about Chateau Rock?
Okay, well, it's Chateau Rock is the name of a place which is inhabited by an old rocker from back in the 1970s in the UK, who became pretty well known and married a much younger woman, and they've had a couple of kids, and now that the kids are about to, one of them's already away at the Royal College of Music, the other one's about to go to university, and so the wife says, that's it, time for a divorce, I want to move on while I'm still young enough to enjoy life rather than being stuck with you, although very fond of you, old man, but there we are. And so they're having a very friendly divorce and a last summer together at this castle with their kids, and Bruno knows the entire family. He taught the kids to play tennis, and he wants to try and organise a farewell concert for the rocker before he leaves the Perigord. And in the middle of all this, there is the death of an old sheep farmer, and to everybody's surprise, when he dies, he's signed away all of his money and all of his land to a rather shadowy insurance company, which was going to put him up in return for all of his property in a very luxurious retirement home for the rest of his life. But he dies before he can go into the retirement home, and all of his money has gone to the insurance company. And Bruno, initially furious that this insurance company has done nothing about the sheep and the lambs, and there's hundreds of ewes and lambs left up there on the farm, he decides to pursue this, and first of all gets them for cruelty to animals and neglect to animals, and then he keeps on going, and we start to realize that behind this insurance company is a rather shadowy Russian figure who is a Russian very rich oligarch who has managed to buy himself a European nationality by just buying one in Cyprus, just as others have done in Malta. And since this is actually something that's been happening in smaller European states, I just wanted to write about that and bring all of these stories in together. So I really had great fun doing it, because some of it took me back to my early days when I was with The Guardian, and I was, as well as writing about politics and stuff, I was also writing about rock music and going to great events like the premiere of the Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, and you know, writing about this old rocker brought all those happy days back.
Oh, lovely, lovely. And are all the books standalone? Should people read the books previously, or can they read them as separate books?
No, you can. They're all standalone. They all work on their own. I mean, the one thing that there is a kind of a logic that takes place is, of course, is in Bruno's romantic life. Mm-hmm. So we're introduced to the first woman in the first book and the second woman in the second book, but they do keep on coming back. But because Bruno adores women, but he can never find, he always falls in love with these strong-minded, successful, independent women who are perfect for him, except they don't want to settle down with him and have children. And he's aching to settle down and have kids.
Oh, so, and that's why all the women love him.
Well, and his cooking helps too.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Well, if people want to get a copy of the latest book, it's called A Shooting at Chateau Rock, and it's available on our website in the TRE bookshop section on tre.radio. It's by Martin Walker, who we've been chatting to. Martin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You're listening to Talk Radio Europe.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is David Albertin, who emigrated to Canada with his family when he was 10 years old. He was born in South Africa. And since 2005, he's been a competitive tennis player and coach. He's with us on the book show to talk about his debut novel, Undercard. It explores the volatile world of professional boxing. Set in Las Vegas, the story centers around four childhood friends now in their 30s. All the action takes place on the strip and in its surrounding desert during one tumultuous 24-hour period. Welcome to the book show, David.
Hi, Hannah. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. So tell me a little bit about your background in tennis. You don't have a boxing background, do you, but sport in general?
Yes, sport in general. Yes, exactly. So I've been a boxing fan my whole life, and I've done a bit of cross training in boxing. So, yes, I grew up, I played a lot of sports, but I mostly did running in track and field. And then in university, I basically switched from track to tennis, and which I had played since a kid, but then I started to play competitively and then coach subsequent to university.
So has your sporting background helped with some of the subject matter in this book then?
Yes, definitely. I mean, one of my thinking just was, you know, the industry really likes it when you have some kind of expertise, I suppose, you know what I mean? And specialization in your writing, you know, that, you know, for sort of added authenticity, I suppose. So when I was constructing the book, I just thought, I wanted to write about a lot of different things, but I thought, make sure you at least have something that people are going to see you as sort of some expertise on. So I wanted all my characters to be athletes.
Mm.
And then, I had an experience where I was training in the main tennis stadium in Toronto, where they have the Rogers Cup, one of the big tennis events. And there's a gym inside it. I used to train there for a bit, like a high performance gym. And when you're inside these stadiums, when there's no event going on, it's like they're just really cool buildings, you know, that you don't, if you just go as a fan, you don't really see like the inner workings.
Mm.
And it's just like these really cool tunnels and everything. And very sort of like it feels like something out of Blade Runner almost, I felt, you know, like these like kind of like very like kind of sleek, cavernous kind of spaces.
Yeah.
And I just thought this would be so cool to set a story like the whole time I was there. So that was from a long time ago. And so really undercard, it was like a lot of lingering ideas really came together in this one project. So it was kind of exciting. So all those things kind of helped have it, give it the sport focus.
Yeah. And how about the setting? Why Vegas?
So Vegas, a variety of reasons. Again, I wanted to kind of deal with issues of like inequality and excesses of power. And the first time I went to Vegas, I happened to witness, I was in a cab and I witnessed this like heavily militarized police presence. Just, the cab was stopped at a red light and just like, you could just sense everyone in all the cars looking over to the side. And there was like this sniper on the roof of a house, like facing away from the street, and we're on like a main street and in full kind of like desert camouflage fatigues, and in a whole unit all dressed like these guys, you know, were like fighting in Iraq or something. And it was a very strange, and then the light turned green and all the cars slowly started driving, like the street wasn't blocked off or anything. And it was just a very strange experience. And then that same day, later that day, a different cab driver sort of told me about, I guess, discriminatory practices by the cab companies there, in regards to favoring like tourists over locals and things like that. So between these experiences, I thought, I'd already in previous like sort of unpublished works tried to deal with issues of like inequality and excessive power. And I thought, if ever you want to do it in like an urban setting, you know, this, and then it's obviously seeing the strip as well, you know, with the complete opposite of just such opulence and excess and everything. I just thought, you know, this is a place where you could deal with a lot of issues.
Yeah, definitely.
And then, so just like that stadium idea, that was lingering with me for a while. And then once I thought I was going to have these four characters, main characters as athletes, and one was a boxer, and then I just thought, oh, Vegas, you know, it's the mecca of professional boxing. So then boxing could be the featured sport. And so it really, it kind of just served so many purposes, kind of met so many demands for the different ideas I had.
There are also some heavy themes in the book, looking at things like racial injustice and police brutality. And obviously the timing of that couldn't be better with the whole world talking about these issues.
Yes, yeah, no, it's kind of uncanny. It's a sort of a strange experience to be in, when it's sort of like, you know, you've been reading, researching about these issues and writing about, you know, so long, and then suddenly, like, the book's coming out right as all this is happening. It is quite funny.
Yeah. So how does that feature in the book, or is that giving too much away?
No, that's okay. So basically, one of the things I wanted to do was have these four characters that all they kind of, they were close growing up and now they're kind of estranged and their motivations are all conflicting with one another. So, and then also, like I said, dealing with sort of these issues that I wanted to deal with. So the one character is a white cop who's now, he's just gotten off, basically been given a not guilty verdict of killing a black unarmed teenager. And then another character who was his best friend growing up is he's a former Marine, a black man, and named Tyrone, so, and the cop is Keenan, and they were best friends growing up, and now he's returned, and his parents were these beloved activists and now he's back in his old community. And everyone is like, you know, we'd like you to follow in your parents' footsteps. And but so it's his kind of dilemma of does he sort of join this kind of protest movement against his against this verdict of not guilty against his former best friend, or does he sort of, you know, stand, you know, stay loyal to his former friend? So there's a lot of kind of tensions like that and things like that in it. So that's kind of the sort of entry point into this issue.
Interesting. And how about the boxing side of things then? Which one of them is a boxer?
So then there's another character, Antoine. So all of, and then the, so the four is, and then the last two is Antoine and Naomi. So Naomi is the wife of Keenan, although it's kind of falling apart largely because of this terrible thing he's done. And Antoine is the former foster brother of Tyrone. So, and he's now fighting in the undercard, which is the preliminary bout for this like mega fight, sort of like this Mayweather-Pacquiao like super fight, like fight of the decade type event. And yeah, he's fighting. He's up against like, you know, like a top prospect, and so it's this fight, and sort of all these characters are sort of coming together around this fight on this Saturday, this one Saturday night.
Exciting. So did you have fun writing it? It sounds like you did.
Yes, I had a lot of fun writing it. Yeah, definitely. I will say, like, it's really, you know, the characters are pretty intense, especially the character Antoine. And it's sort of, you know, this revenge is kind of like this theme in it. So it's at times, like, emotionally sort of intense to write. But I really enjoyed it. Yeah, I mean, I was coming up with a story for about 2 years before I started writing. So it was just, it was an amazing feeling when I started the first chapter. It just kind of flowed in a way nothing I'd ever written had flowed before. So it was really a joy to write.
Yeah, and I love the idea that the whole thing is set in 24 hours. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, that's another idea that had been with me, I think, since I was a kid. You know, I just love that idea of like a one day story. And, you know, it's obviously there's been stories like that, you know, not that often, but, you know, there always are, you know, stories like that coming out. And I always wanted to do that. And it just came about when, you know, as I was starting to put the pieces together and like the ingredients together, you know, Vegas and these characters, and I knew I wanted them, you know, this boxing match and then this protest and as well. And I just realized that with a boxing match normally taking place on a Saturday night and protests often taking place in the morning, that I could kind of have the whole thing kind of revolve around these two events, and that this could then be like my 24-hour narrative. So it was a lot of fun to write, yeah.
Does it give you a bit of freedom having it just as 24 hours, or is it quite restrictive in a way? How did you view it?
I think I didn't find it restrictive in terms of the writing. I found it sort of difficult and challenging to make it all fit together, but I didn't find it restrictive. And there are sort of flashbacks. I mean, the entire story takes place over 20 years, so you do get the reflections of the characters sort of seamlessly in it, you know, that reflect in the past. So gradually the backstories of all the characters are filled in, and you sort of learn the whole story.
Yeah.
Over the course of it. But so no, I didn't find it restrictive. And in some ways, you know, having like these kind of parameters really helps, you know, just helps focus the plot, and it helps you just come up with, you know, just working out scenes. Okay, what are they doing now? How's it all going to fit together? But then at the same time, it is quite challenging just making sure it all links up and it all, you know, it's all satisfying, but it all makes sense, you know, that it doesn't get... you know, it's implausible that these things, you know what I mean, would happen in this time frame.
Yeah.
So it was good, yeah.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, have you already started your next book?
Yes. I'm a good way along, I'd say. I'd say I'm about maybe halfway through the first draft, although I've got sort of it mostly mapped out. And this one's going to be in the sort of tennis club world. And... I think it'll be a lot of fun. It's a lot funnier. I wanted to do something of more humor, but it's still like, it's more murder mystery, but a lot of sort of sex and relationships and things like that, and the sort of sordid a lot of sordid relationships revolving around a tennis club.
Sounds great.
Yeah. I actually, for research, I've asked around some tennis pro buddies, and there's a lot of stories. Like, I didn't even know the half of it. Like, if you ever, I was thinking to say to people, if you ever doubt your partner's fidelity, you should not let them play tennis.
Wow. Okay. I'll remember that. That's great advice. Thank you, David. If people want to get a copy of the book, it's called Undercard and it's available on our website, tre.radio. We've been chatting to the author, David Albertin. David, thanks very much for joining us and best of luck.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed it. I appreciate it.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Charlie Mills to talk about his debut children's book. It's called It's Cool to Be Me, and it follows a child on an enchanting adventure of a lifetime. He wrote the story at 16 years old when Instagram and other social media platforms started to take over the lives of everyone around him. Welcome to the show, Charlie.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for joining us. So very exciting it must be having your own book out. You're 22 now. That's great to have brought a book out.
Yeah, it's a big surprise to me. For sort of a year ago, I'd never have imagined that I'd actually pursue this. But since sort of having the money and the time and thinking that I actually want to take a risk and sort of pursuing my creative endeavour, I thought, why not? And now I've got physical copies of it going out everywhere, which is amazing.
Oh, wonderful. And am I right in saying that you did all the illustrations as well?
No, so I didn't actually do all the illustrations. I worked with an illustration company from North Macedonia, actually. And I had to sort of send over all the ideas in my head, and then they managed to put it down and do all the amazing illustrations, which I honestly couldn't be happier with.
Oh, wonderful. So it was a real collaborative process.
Yes, yes.
Brilliant. So looking at the story then, tell us about the main child, the main character in the book.
So the main character is a little boy who he's doing well at school. He does sports and stuff. So he's sort of your average child. But he goes to bed one night wondering if people think he's cool. And there's sort of a worry in the back of his head that I think every child does have. They sort of worry about other people's opinions of them. So one night he makes a wish to be cool, and then he wakes up and there's a genie floating in the garden. He runs down and the genie says, well, how can I help? And he says, well, I wish to be cool. And the genie takes him on this adventure where he meets a dragon who ends up taking a selfie, and some giants and some other characters, and they try to help him realize that it's actually cool just to be himself. He doesn't need to worry about impressing others.
Oh, wow. So it's a great message to get across, because there's a lot of pressure on kids to be cool, and you know, that dealing with making friends and bullying and things, it's tough.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a lot of, like you said, there's a lot of pressure on kids, and I think at a certain age, you go to school thinking that you need to impress certain people, or you need to act a different way to how you would actually like to act. So I think the message of It's Cool to Be Me, where children can learn to love themselves and embrace the differences that make them unique, will sort of help people that may be bullies sort of recognize that their differences are okay and accepting themselves. And then the people, like victims of bullying as well, like they won't take sort of the things that bullies are saying to heart, because if they know that they love themselves, then it won't affect them as much. Mm-hmm. So it's a story for sort of both sides of bullying, and just for children in general to realize that it's fine to be who you are.
Yeah, for sure. And with social media and things, I guess that doesn't help. I mean, you say about a lot of kids, you know, obviously using things like Instagram and various other forms of social media. And a lot of kids and adults, I think, in fairness, really judge themselves on how many likes their post gets. And there's lots of filters so you can change the way that you look to make yourself look slimmer or clearer skin or whatever. And do you think all of that makes things harder for kids?
Yeah, definitely, because I think people get a false perception and can give a false perception of who they are. And especially now, sort of at school 15, 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, if something was affecting you at school, you could come home and escape that. But nowadays, you go to school and then you come home and everything is so prevalent on social media that you can't even escape it. So I definitely think that there are massive negative implications of social media, especially for teenagers and, I mean, also adults. But when you're going through mood swings and you've got exams and stuff like that, it's something on top that you do not need, like that added pressure of social media.
Absolutely. So now the book is out there, have you kind of fulfilled your dream, or do you think you want to do more?
So I think I've fulfilled stage one and two of my dream, where I've managed to produce it, managed to get it out there. It's actually on Kickstarter at the moment, which is a crowdfunding platform. So I'm trying to raise money to be able to do a big print and order a lot of books so that I can keep the price of the book down. So that's got another 9 days left of the campaign. I think it's 3/4 of the way funded, which is really exciting. And then the stage after that would be to try and get it onto sort of national retailers' bookshelves. And then I've also written another book, which I'm going to start the illustrating process with, probably over the next couple of weeks as well. So it's a very exciting time, and being in lockdown, it's given me quite a lot of time to put energy into it. So as awful as this time has been, it's been quite a productive time for me.
Yeah. Oh, well done you. Well, if people want to find out more information and help you along with the Kickstarter project, how do they do that?
So if you go to my website, it's cooltobeme.co.uk. And from there, there's links on the website on the homepage, which will take you straight to the Kickstarter. Or if you follow It's Cool To Be Me on Facebook, follow the page, or It's Cool To Be Me book on Instagram. There's links on the profiles of both those pages, which will take you straight to the Kickstarter as well.
Fantastic. Well, we wish you all the best with it, Charlie. And with all the books that you think you might do in your future, do you think you'll stick to being a children's author, or might you look into other genres?
I think being a children's book author allows me to express my creativity and my silly, rhyming, fun side, which I really enjoy. And being able to put across my ideas for illustrations as well, and all the sort of Easter eggs I can put in the book. So with this book, there's lots of Easter eggs from my favourite things as a child. So it's got Forrest Gump shoes and some football posters of my favourite team and stuff like that. So all of those little bits I really enjoy. So I think sticking to children's books will be the sort of the near future. Maybe we'll stray away in the future, but I think children's books is where it's at for me at the moment.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. Good for you. Well, if people want to get a copy of the book, it's called It's Cool To Be Me, and it's available on our website. Listeners can get a copy from there. It's by Charlie Mills, who we've been chatting to. Charlie, thanks so much for joining us, and best of luck.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a good day.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.